Hello, my name is Sarah Ruschak, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I'm joined today by Dr. Robin Darling Young, professor of church history at the Catholic University of America. Tonight, she'll be giving the 2024 Molly and Wayne Borges Memorial Lecture titled Danger, Purity, and the Holy Land Past and Present. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I read an article in NPR about your experience with Adelie Fopaisis while traveling in Jerusalem. So I was wondering, how does experiencing what you are studying affect your methods of gathering information and your perspectives on the topic?
That's a great question. Oh. Thank you. Well, I would say there are at least two levels of how that works for me. Number one, I find it easier to visualize what happens in a landscape if you see the landscape. And if you see, you know, of course the landscape has changed since the period I study, but in some places not that much. And seeing the layout of things, the social world that has some direct connection to the social world as it was in the period that you study, and also understanding how the people there themselves see you as a Western, you know, researcher. Because you would always go, I would always go, with some purpose in mind, you know, to give a scholarly paper, to look at a manuscript, to see a building that I was really interested in that at one time housed some particular kind of community. For instance, it's now destroyed, but Aleppo. In Aleppo, you see a kind of layering of communities that you don't really experience reading scholarly works in the way that they are organized by scholarly convention. Mm-hmm. So I think what I'm saying is that there is a freedom of exploration that comes with actually getting your own feet on the ground in those places. So that's, I think that's one reason. And I think another reason, so that might be more on the research and learning level. Another reason is that most of the materials with which I work belong to those people there. They're not our materials. We collected them because, and by we, I mean Western scholars, collected them because we're interested in the past as we construe it. The past that, and I'm not making an accusation here, but the past as we, with our perspective, allows us to see it. But other people in those areas that I study, so that would be a kind of band from Armenia all the way down through, you know, Egypt, or at least the northern part of Egypt, and including Greece and even parts of Italy because of, you know, cultural interchange. The people who live there are very, very aware of the past, much more aware of the past than Americans are, no surprise. And so they have opinions on what your research is and what your questions are. Mm-hmm. I find it very interesting to listen to their opinions and to have exchange with people. Not everybody in those places is interested in, you know, some text from the 4th century, but they are. But most have a sense, especially in the Middle East, of their own long, long culture and what it means in their community.
I love it. Thank you. What originally drew you to studying early Christian theology?
Oh, good question. I had meant to be a scholar of Middle English. Mm. I was interested in Chaucer when I was in an all-women's undergraduate school many, many years ago. But I was told that the hardest professor in the school which was an all-women's college at the time, was the most, also the most demanding person in the school. And some urge, which could have been slightly masochistic or more, or slightly athletic, I don't know, drew me to her classes. And she, after she was at that school, my alma mater, Mary Washington, she actually went and became quite a prominent professor at Duke. Her name was Elizabeth Clark. And she was a second wave, committed second or third wave feminist. Anyway, she was a feminist of the 60s, and she was very, very interested in women's education and independence. And she was, she lived up to her reputation as the most demanding person in the school. And you were not going to win compliments easily from her. You know, this was a long time ago. And after all, I had gone through public schools where they actually, you know, physically beat students if they didn't. Not that she was like that, but that you would, please edit that out, but that you were used to sitting there and being told by a professor. The thing about her was that she also wanted to be friends with her students to the extent possible, that you can be a friend if you're older and, you know, more educated. But she would make sure that she would invite us over to her house. She took an interest in us personally. I think I was, at the time, sort of afraid of her. But she encouraged me to go to graduate school after a couple of years of working. And so she pointed me in that direction. In the meantime, I had abandoned Middle English and Chaucer and all other possibilities of that sort, and moved into her area, which is the study of early Christianity. So I had only had Latin in high school, so I was a little hampered. I had to start Greek before I got in the years, 2 years between college and high and graduate school. But she was also very interested, and I was very interested at the time, of course, following her, in Augustine of Hippo, a sort of formative thinker for the Western medieval tradition, both philosophical and theological, very important in the history of Western Christianity. Eventually I decided I wanted to go to the University of Chicago for a similar reason. It was reputed to be really hard, and it was really hard. They cut you no slack. And so that seemed to be a good way to learn. I'm not sure if it is, but to my mind then, I thought, well, this is really a great challenge. And also it was in the city of Chicago, which I love. And I went there, but there was nobody working on Augustine. I had done my undergraduate thesis on Augustine. But there was somebody teaching Syriac Christianity. And that was completely different. I'd never really heard of it before. It was fascinating. It was a Christianity that was formed not by the Greek tradition or the Roman tradition, but by the Jewish tradition more directly. And its language was Aramaic, which it shared in one form or another, with the peoples of the Near East who were not speaking either Greek or Persian. So that meant I had to learn Syriac, and that was very attractive. That was very attractive because the University of Chicago at that time had an institute which was called the Oriental Institute. They changed the name recently for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. But they offered the entire spectrum of ancient Near Eastern languages. And I later, about 20 years later, had the pleasure of going back there to be their visiting Armenian professor, so I could teach Armenian, which I learned in the meantime, but not in Chicago. So being introduced to the world of ancient languages and ancient cultures at such a place, which studied not only the languages, but the monuments, the people who founded the Oriental Institute had gone on opportunistic archaeological digs run by Europeans. Okay, this is a whole, this has become a really fraught question in the past 3 years. I guess it would take us too long to go into it. And I wasn't so aware of it at the time. In the latter part of the 20th century, we took for granted that we should be that we should have brought all these monuments and statues and so forth here, where Western people could appreciate them. Anyway, so that was all there, the spoils, so to speak, of archaeological exhibits and training in languages. And I was in the divinity school, so I was learning the history of, not only the history of Christianity, but the history of the cultures and religions of the ancient Near East. I got to take an independent study in ancient astronomy, which remains an interest. It was just it was a very rich experience. So then I wrote a dissertation on a Syriac topic. And only later, and I worked on Syriac for a long time, only later did I sort of circle back to Greek and Latin, but anyway, and Armenian. But I think it was a sense, both in college in one way and at the University of Chicago in another way, that you could explore. And exploring these languages and what they meant in themselves, the cultures, the distinctiveness of the cultures, and also, even maybe possibly more interesting, the overlap of the cultures and how they would intertwine with each other sort of at the borders, you know. That was very interesting.
Thinking about when you were teaching.
Yes.
So you talked about the experience of having these really influential professors and these like kind of aha moments.
Yes.
And obviously learning and exploring and in the Middle East. How do you convey that to your students?
Well, I think I've been in the position for almost all of my career until the last 20 years of teaching graduate students. So they were coming already with a focus. Undergraduates, it's often a little bit more difficult. And that probably depends on what kind of college you're in. But I think what I try to convey is not experience in a particular place, but openness to levels of meaning of a text and levels of meaning of a culture. So I don't say don't in my classes, but I would encourage students to wait and begin to listen to the text that they read and to listen in conversations and not impose previous the categories that they already have, but to try to make themselves aware of how differently different cultures, even different Christian cultures, operate. And the assumptions that they have, and how not only do they communicate, but completely miss each other. And I think that's where that experience might influence how I teach. With my graduate students, it's sort of similar. We usually would work on ancient texts in translation, and then sometimes, you know, it can't be all reading in Greek, for instance. But if we would read a Greek text, then we would take time not to impose our own meaning on the words or the sentences or the paragraphs, but to try to understand how the authors are expressing themselves and expressing themselves at different levels, because they knew how to do that, expressing themselves at different levels to differing sections of audiences that they imagine themselves to have. So I think that I try to, I'm going to say one more thing about the source of this. I had a very wonderful professor in graduate school named Jonathan Z. Smith. He was a historian of religion and quite, in a sense, a theorist, but he also disputed theories that you imposed from the outside on texts. And he tried to convey zeal of investigation and curiosity, not to rule anything out. And he worked on ancient texts, all the way from magical texts to sort of Gnostic texts to high literary texts, and he didn't have devotion toward any of them. He wasn't undevoted, but he was equally curious about all of them. The spirit of investigation, and I hope that my students understand, but it's hard to convey this by saying, you know, here's your first commandment, do this. So I hope I would allow and encourage students to just explore what seems important to them in the text and then come and talk about it with other people and work it out.
So kind of on the topic of exploring what seems important to you.
Yes.
I know that there was a topic change for this lecture from your original, what you really wanted to talk about.
Yes.
So what do you think is the value of studying more obscure aspects of religion like Gnosticism?
I don't study Gnosticism, actually, or I don't study what most people think of as capital G Gnostic texts, because I think it's a false category. They study it because a bunch of texts were collected in papyri, written on papyri, collected and stored in jars near a monastery in Egypt, and when they were exhumed, they were called the Nag Hammadi corpus. That Nag Hammadi corpus just takes its name from the location where those things happen to be found. And there's no necessary relation among them, just that somebody buried them because he didn't want somebody else to see them. And so they then developed an aura of secrecy, which maybe if you had asked the people in that monastery who buried them, this goes back to my earlier point, what does all this mean to you? They would have said, well, this was just the stuff that fit in the jars, you know? That Gnosticism has the appeal of heresy, which is kind of exciting if you are impatient with Orthodox or conventional or evangelical Christianity, right? So people liked it, especially like people in universities. And I'm not plugging Orthodox Christianity. I'm just making I'm giving a description. I'm interested in, and I would have talked about, and I actually am putting at the end of my talk tonight, so I'm not abandoning it entirely. I would have talked about a movement, what I would describe as philosophical teachers who are Christian in antiquity. So we have tended to classify some of these teachers as theologians, if they interpreted the Bible, for instance. But there was no such thing as a theologian in early Christianity. There were people who wrote laws. There were people who interpreted literature, including the Bible. And there were people who gave sermons. And none of it was theology in the way we think of theology. So the people who were interested in gnosis or gnosis, knowledge, or Gnosticism, were interested in what happens to a person who gains higher knowledge, like more philosophical knowledge. Mm-hmm. And since they were all operating on the assumption that has been made famous by a certain French student or scholar, they were assuming that philosophy is a way of life, not just something you do in your study, but actually a way of life, where you are trained to be virtuous so that you can know. Those people, you can call them Christian Gnostics or Gnostics with a small g, but that, in my view, that's the most promising part of Christianity, if you want to even be interested in Christianity having a promise, and I don't think everybody has to do that. I'm just saying that's what I study. And it's intriguing because you see that they are reinterpreting Plato, they're reinterpreting Homer, and they're making it fit with a Christianity which was to some extent extrinsic to that world, but gets taken into that world and then enwrapped, as I was, you know, talking about earlier, wrapped inside, you know, the Greek tradition. So anyway, that's what I studied. And I also think that that a lot of it is actually true. A lot of their observations are true philosophically. So that's what I study. But then when I was talking back and forth to people here, they said they wanted something more contemporary.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that. Actually, still don't understand it. But I said, okay, because I like this topic. I mean, I also like to talk about the contemporary situation in the world from which my subjects came. So I can do that. And I was, topic is a little bit delicate at this point, right? Because there's a big war going on. And there are two parties who are laying claim to the same thing, as I'm going to say tonight. Some of those claims can be explained through ancient understanding of what place and body mean. And so that's, I figured I could change, not entirely lose what I wanted to do, because I think what I want to do is actually an alternative to the things that cause war, namely claims on territory and bodies, right? And I thought they want me to do something more of present interest, because presumably that would draw a bigger audience and not be so, you know, obscure. So I'm happy to come out of my obscurity and and engage the Holy Land, which was formed by the people I study, mm-hmm. for good or ill.
So, kind of going back to what you were originally saying about the birth of quote unquote Gnosticism.
Yes.
How big of a problem do you think modern theologians and historians assigning meaning to these ancient traditions are?
Well, you know, there's fortunately no one, we don't have a censor in the United States. There's no censorship of opinions that I think are wrong, or my opinions that somebody else thinks are wrong. It just has to be debated out in the public forum, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I'm completely down with that. If it means aggravation or closely pursued argument, that's the First Amendment, which is my favorite amendment, because I really do not want to see anybody censored. You know, within reason, yeah. We have a legal interpretation of that. But so I think that anyone can propose anything. You know, the guy I work on, Evagrius of Pontus, who's my, you know, main squeeze, as they say, not the only one, but, you know, the main one, he was condemned as a heretic. And it was, some of his writings were destroyed in Greek, but they were fortunately survived in Syriac and Armenian, which were at that point outside, at the date of that condemnation, they were outside of the Roman Empire, so they couldn't be, you know, collected and burned. Back then, at the end of the 19th century, when scholars were beginning to publish his works based on Syriac manuscripts in the British Library that they discovered, or in the Berlin Library, whatever. I mean, the great age of German philology, the late 19th century. The people who were interested in him, who were largely people who were in some way involved in monasticism, because that was the monastic movement was where he had his chief impact, for reasons I can say later. They said, oh, you know, he's more a Buddhist than a Christian, so he's not really a Christian at all. Well, that's, you know, yeah, prove it. So there's a lot of debate around that. But I recently saw a book, which I will purchase, by someone who is a Buddhist teacher in Chicago, who wrote an entire book about Evagrius as a Buddhist. So, you know, that's his opinion. Mm-hmm. Actually, what he was a Neoplatonist philosopher who had something in common with Buddhism, because Buddhism has teachings that resemble Western philosophical teachings that have to do with, you know, curing bad behavior. Everybody's human, right? And everybody tends to display the same kind of bad behavior. And the problem for these guys, Buddhist teachers and Evagrius, is if you have bad habits, you can't think. And you can't engage in contemplating the truths of reality. So you have to get rid of the bad habits first. That's a long journey. So, okay, I think it all just works out with debate. Nobody controls how someone who died in the year 400 is received in the year 2025, right? You don't. You just have to keep talking about it. Unless you are in a society that censors free expression, which is not a good thing.
No. It's a great answer. Thank you.
Yes.
What do you think has been one of the most rewarding moments in your research or travels?
Well, I have one whole class of that won't surprise you at all, and that is having on a desk, on a reading stand, in front of me, a manuscript from the 5th century. That is the only surviving manuscript. So I was working once on a Jewish work composed at about 100, very much like the Book of Revelation. It's called 4th Ezra. And I was working with a Jewish friend on the interpretation of this work, which both belonged to the Jewish community but was taken by Christians, lightly Christianized, and put in the Christian Bible. And we were working on it together and talking about it from each of our different angles, hers from the Jewish tradition, mine from the Syriac Christian tradition, and actually had the manuscript in front of us. And the thing is, having the manuscript in front of us, or in front of you, shows you the people who actually copied it and were understanding it at the time, especially if they put a colophon at the end, which is a kind of explanation of who wrote this, and usually the name of a scribe, and often a request for the reader to pray for the scribe. That's a kind of formal request in the ancient world. Even more so in Armenian texts, where the manuscript colophon is a very expansive tradition, and you learn about in what monastery these were produced, and then if you know something about that place, you know about the conditions. In other words, you find out the context from this book and by using your other knowledge. I think that the connection, and here, this is, I'm supposed, quite telling, but the connection with those who came before us and put these things together it's mind-blowing. It's really cool. And then the other thing is, I love to work with other scholars, and I write my own. If I have an essay to write, for instance, I'll write that by myself, but I love to translate texts with other scholars, because a text is heard differently by different people. And if you discuss it, and this, of course, will take you back to, guess who? Plato. If you are discussing this with other people, truth comes out in discussion, in dialogue. That's what the whole purpose of those dialogues are, is to show you that. And I think that's true to a certain extent in academic conferences, if they're not too, trivial. But it really comes out in discussions in seminars, or with my favorite place, or with your colleagues. If you are friends with a colleague. So for instance, I'm doing a big translation right now. It's due at the end of January, so I hope we'll make it. But the person with whom I'm working is a friend from graduate school. So we've known each other for 50 years, and it's a no-holds-barred experience. But it's great, because we actually produce something better than either of us would by ourselves. So that's the other thing.
That sounds great. Sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's wonderful. We, as with the Evagrius collection that I published recently with a team, this is our, we both have things to do in the day. I'm still teaching. He's retired. So we do it religiously from 7 to 9 in the morning. And that's how, of course, you make progress. You just do it. And, it's like that famous book, Bird by Bird. How do you get something done? One thing after the other, after the other, after the other, and then it's done. And that works better with another person, because you owe something to that other person, and he owes it to you, or she owes it to you, and you have a common goal. And I think it's great. I mean, single author works are great too, but if you want to do a translation where you're trying to let the text speak to people in your own decade, that's a great experience.
If I may ask, what is that?
Oh, of course you may ask. It is a beautiful 3rd century work called the Contra Celsum, which is the defense of philosophical Christianity against the accusations of another philosopher. So this Platonist philosopher writes a long book called The True Logos, which criticizes early Christianity for a number of things, which I doubtless were true, but Origen responds in his work Contra Celsum as if he were a lawyer in a courtroom. I mean, he does this rhetorically. A lawyer in a courtroom rebutting a very, very long argument. So he goes on for 8 solid books. It's a huge work, and it's been translated before, but of course we have our differences with those translators. And our translation will have a facing Greek text so people can, you know, compare what we do to the Greek, which is great because you can see then how the Greek is working and how we've had to alter it in a sense because no language works in the same way. So that's interesting too. Like, it's an interesting, knotty problem. How do you straighten this out so that you can actually, Greek can come out in a way that English readers can understand it. I'm not kidding myself that we're going to have more than, you know, max 50 readers. I know this. But the series is called Graphi, and they want to publish ancient texts from Syriac, from ancient Persian, from Armenian, Georgian, Coptic, Ethiopic, Greek, and apparently have the funding to do it. So we said, yes, let's. And here we are, 3 years on, almost done with the third version of the translation. So that's how it works. And in the meantime, each of us is writing our own things. So,
well, congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. I mean, I really recommend it. And
I wish I didn't have to say this, but I do think we're running out of time. But
yeah.
Is there any like final comment you would want to make before?
To anybody?
Well, anything we didn't touch on that you need to talk about.
Dear world, please don't shut down the humanities. Do what you love. That's my comment.
Okay.
Even now, even in this very difficult year, do what you love.
That's very nice.
Okay.
So this concludes our interview. On behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you again for sitting down with me.
And thank you for having me.
Thank you.